Morning, everybody. We've been working through the book of James for a number of weeks now, and the overarching theme of the book is how is our faith authenticated by how we live out Christ's values in our everyday lives. So, in other words, is how does what we believe either validated or invalidated by what we actually do? And it's primarily a book that's speaking to Christian believers, and it's making observations about the kind of behaviour that exists in real life compared to what we think Christians ought to behave like. And previous passages have dealt with how we respond to trials, how we withstand temptation, loving your neighbour. Ruth's one last week was on wisdom. And this week's passage sort of focuses on quarrels and fights that occur, if you like, within the congregation. James is setting before us a very basic question. Is our aim in life to submit to the will of God, or is it to gratify our desires by seeking the pleasures that the world has to offer? And when I say that, I worry that I'm kind of going down the road of some sort of fire and brimstone sermon of saying, can't enjoy what the world has to offer. And I hope that what we're not going to do is leave here all feeling guilty about enjoying stuff, because that's not what it's about. But I do hope that we go away with a recognition of what our natural tendencies are, and we're a bit more conscious and a bit more intentional about what we say and do and how we conduct ourselves. And in particular, with a heightened sense of the special relationship that we share as a group of believers. And in so doing, I kind of want to pick up on the threads of Ruth's sermon last week, that godly wisdom lies in the relationships that we have with others and in humility. Now, if we get into this passage, quarrels and fights were plainly occurring among these Christian believers, and James obviously felt the need to put them straight on a few things. They were told in chapter 1, love thy neighbour, and there's obviously a disconnect with how that's being worked out in real life. And he identifies the root cause of those quarrels and fights as the desires that battle within you. And I think it's important that we explore that and we dig a little bit deeper into that, because sometimes it's a little bit uncomfortable. What are the desires that he's talking about? Well, we've actually spoken about this a lot over the last few weeks and into the previous series as well on the Good and Beautiful Life. This Greek word, epithumia, this sort of inner craving for things that give us pleasure. And I'm going to focus on one particular aspect of that that I know that I'm susceptible to. And it's the desire to sort of come across as successful. And that comes through in lots of different guises. And it's the pleasure that we derive from just being recognized or admired by other people for things, achievements that we may have. And it might come from our success in the workplace. It might come from sort of material success. We've got a nice house. We live in a lovely area. It might come from our children, you know, how well they've turned out and the impressive things that they do, or personal goals that we've achieved, maybe some sporting successes. Sometimes it even comes through that sort of satisfaction that you get from being proven right. You've sort of made a statement about something and all of a sudden you kind of feel superior. I got that one right. And we might not openly state what our desires are, but would it be true to say that most of us have some view of what being successful looks like? And even that we might measure our success by how we're doing versus what other people are doing. Here's some examples. Maybe you can see if you identify with them. You don't have to shout out. If I was to ask you, for instance, what would you consider is more successful? First or fourth place? An A grade or a D grade? Porsche or Ford? A company director or an accounts clerk? Would you consider it more successful if you gained entry to Oxford University or Oxford Brookes? Or if you had a salary of £80,000 or £18,000? Or if you've got a great successful corporate career or you're a homemaker? Which ones do you naturally lean towards? Which one do we consider kind of represent success. Can I put it to you that there's a strong desire within us to want to appear successful, and it's a form of pride, that feeling of deep pleasure or satisfaction from our own achievements. You might even call it smugness, or from qualities or possessions that are widely admired by other people. And it's very powerful, and it can be very subtle, and it's often shaped by our prejudices. And James explains how this desire for pleasure, this particular worldly pleasure, is at the heart of why we quarrel and fight. And the Message translation puts it a little bit harsher than the NIV. Where do you think these wars and quarrels come from? Do you think they just happen? Think again. They come about because you want to have your own way and you fight for it deep inside yourselves. You lust for what you don't have and are willing to kill to get it. You want what isn't yours and will risk violence to get your hands on it. Well, he says that the desires that battle within us are born out of envy, a dear desire to have something that we don't already have in order to fulfill some view of ourselves, something that we're going to be more happy with. And when that pleasure is satisfied, we experience pride. We may be jealous of what others have. We may covet what they have in belief that somehow having those things might make us feel better. In the UK, there's quite a scientific term for that condition. We call it keeping up with the Joneses. We may want possessions of some kind. Rockefeller, who was the oil magnate in the States, at one time the wealthiest man in the world. He had every possession. He didn't have to be envious of anybody else. But when he was asked the question, how much money is enough, his response was, just a little bit more. Why? Because when you've got everything, actually, you still want to rank slightly above other people. And that's a way of keeping score. So pride's linked to status and can also come from being seen as the smart person who always gets it right. We want to be right in our opinions. It increases our status as someone to be listened to. We kind of feel that superiority, and it fuels that pleasure of pride, that desire that battles within us. It's a form of craving that can cause tension between us and a source of arguments, can be a real Achilles heel for us. Maybe think back to your own context. Look back at your week for a second, whether that might have been at work or at home, whatever context you found yourself in. Were there some relationships which were difficult because of a difference of opinion, which maybe can be traced back to pride? Were there any prejudices that influence you that maybe run the danger of clouding your view a bit? Like James here, Peter counsels us in his second letter. He says, "Dear friends, I urge you, as aliens and strangers in the world, to abstain from sinful desires which wage war against your soul." Quarrels are often the result of differences of opinion. We must be careful to not let our differences tempt us to feel superior. Otherwise, we end up undermining the very thing that makes us strong, our relationships with each other. God's wisdom lies in how we manage our relationships. In other words, we've got to be aware of those kind of animal instincts that we have, of pride that kind of drive those desires and our attitudes towards each other. But does that mean at the end of the day that we end up not venturing an opinion or a thought on anything because we're worried about upsetting people's feelings? Well, no. Do we restrain our skills, we restrain our giftings and everything that makes us who we are and ignore our ambitions to improve ourselves? No. Do we suppress our drive and our creativity that leads us to compete and to do our best? I don't think so, because I think that God invented all of those things. He invented diversity and creativity. He created competitiveness and ambition. And he created them as qualities for us to enjoy. He chose to make us different. He chose to make us asymmetrical. He chose to make us multicolored, oftentimes ambiguous, often confusing to one another. He wants us to have different opinions. He wants us to debate, to develop our understanding. As iron sharpens iron, so one person sharpens another. And he wants us to do it with the right motivation and the right perspective. It's how we do it that he's interested in. He doesn't want us motivated by pride. He wants us motivated by his will. But we need to recognize that the diversity of talent and perspective and ambition that exists within us makes us all different, can be both a source of strength and a source of weakness. We can either choose to focus on those differences and make it divisive, or we can choose to see them as complementary. So each person can be seen as a different piece of a jigsaw puzzle, part of a bigger picture. When we're doing a jigsaw, we don't say, I've got a better piece of the puzzle than you have. My bit's more valuable. I've got a bit of sky and you've got a tree. That would be stupid. We're allowing our pride to get in the way. In order to be successful in putting that jigsaw puzzle together, we have to collaborate. We've got to find other bits of sky. I've got to help you find your bits of tree. And gradually, the whole picture starts to emerge. We might not know in advance what that picture looks like. Some puzzle people who are really expert at it insist that you can't look at the box to see what the picture looks like. And it's a bit like that. We kind of have to trust that there's a picture there and that the picture will emerge and that we believe that all of those pieces will fit together in the end. Well, that's God designed us to be different and diverse in that way. Not so that we quarrel to find out whose bit is superior, but that we live in community, we collaborate and depend upon each other for the success of bringing that picture together. And that's what helps us to grow. The key to using our diversity as a strength and avoiding those fights and quarrels is to reflect on our motives, recognize when our pride is getting in the way, and then try and maintain a trust that there is that bigger picture that's going to come through. And I want to go back to what I said at the beginning. I want to stress that there's nothing wrong with wanting a pleasurable life. God gives us good gifts and he wants us to enjoy them. But what we do often involves seeking pleasure at the expense of others or at the expense of obeying God. So it's our motives that we need to examine, and that's what James addresses next. At the heart of his message, he says in verse 7, show a bit of humility. Recognize your motives. Submit yourselves to God. He wants us to recognize God for who he is and to recognize ourselves that we're really a work in progress. Mark Twain, you'll know, put it like this. He said, when I was a boy of 14, my father was so ignorant, I could hardly stand to have the old man around. But when I got to be 21, I was astonished at how much the old man had learned in 7 years. As a teacher of teenagers, I've got a great deal of sympathy with Mark Twain's observation. Teenagers are absolutely 100% confident that they know exactly what they're doing, and any authority figure who gets in their way is just out of touch with how life really works. But isn't that the way that our relationship is with God? We come here to church on a Sunday. We worship the creator of the universe, the one who has no beginning and no end. We listen to the teachings of Jesus, the one perfect person to ever walk the earth. We explore the wisdom of the teaching in our home groups. And then on Monday, we forget about it all and go out and do our own thing again, hoping that the little fish on the back of our car is going to help us out. Driven by our pride and reacting rather than responding to the world around us. And here's the point. We're no different to the first century Christians that James is writing to. He's saying, come on, you know what you're like. Show some humility. You know that your loyalty is divided between, on the one hand, allowing yourself to be sucked into the status games that the world wants to play, and on the other hand, standing back, being patient, letting God determine your steps. In Proverbs, it's written, all a person's ways seem innocent to them, but motives are weighed by the Lord. And we're kidding ourselves, frankly, if we think otherwise. God's wisdom lies in humility. And to counter this, James encourages us to submit ourselves to God, come near to him, and just get a grip on those motives and those selfish desires. He wants us to build our relationship with God and develop a healthy perspective of that big picture just by owning up and asking forgiveness, coming clean, and then trusting that he's going to give us what we need when we really need it. But it's hard. It's hard, and it goes against our natural tendencies. And guess what? God knows it's hard. People are made different. So he gives us different people. People that are up when we're low. People who are patient when we're impatient. People who are calm when we're angry. People who are sensible when we're foolish. He surrounds us with diverse people in order to help us. But he ensures that those people are united by a belief in him, a common belief that there's that big picture, bigger than ourselves, a big picture of the good and beautiful life that was modeled by Jesus. And through that combination of us working together and being unified like that, he makes us stronger. Ecclesiastes, though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. As we work together rather than fight each other, we become stronger and resilient. And when we're tempted to put others down in an attempt to sort of make ourselves feel better, James calls us to remember, there's only one lawgiver and judge, the one who's able to save and destroy. But you, who are you to judge your neighbour? We're called to love our neighbour, not judge our neighbour. And when we criticise or make those negative comments, we're putting ourselves in God's position. And we've got to challenge our motives, our thoughts, our words, and consider whether we're speaking in order to build people up or to knock them down. Drawing near to God, resisting evil, means setting ourselves the goal of trying to always find something beneficial to others in order to cure ourselves of that habit of finding fault. Simply put, if we can't say something nice, then don't say anything at all. So to sum up, our prayers will become more powerful when we allow God to change our desires so that they correspond with his will for us, when we allow him to form our motives rather than running ahead driven by those desires. Jeff Lucas wrote this recently. He said, sometimes the success of others makes our own limitations harder to bear. We don't like it, so we go on the attack. And we need to be particularly aware and on the lookout for our natural tendencies, our epithumia, particularly pride. Let's see those differences as God-given for the reason of building us up, for making us stronger, for enriching our lives. And let's value each other as a piece of the jigsaw puzzle of that bigger picture of the good and beautiful life. And where we can't agree, and that will be many, at least acknowledge in humility that maybe we just don't see the whole picture at the moment. Rather than quarrelling with each other driven by our pride, let's be peacemakers who seek to celebrate each other's success, trusting ultimately that in all things God works for the good of those who love him. Amen.